Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, do you live with any blind spots? Are you conscious of everything? What do you still need to figure out? Well, let's find out, because actually there's a book called Blind Spots, which helps us see what we don't understand or what we might be lost about. And to help us understand this wonderful book is the author, who's a great thinker. He's been on the show before. I'm fascinated with the depth of his work and the complexity of his thinking. And so I welcome Christian DeQuincy to the show. Welcome, Christian.
Hi, Peter. It's good to be back and good talking to you again.
This is wonderful to understand the nature of your work about consciousness, because it really is your calling card, isn't it?
Studying consciousness?
Yeah.
That's my major focus. My professional academic training is in philosophy, specifically philosophy of mind. And in my work, I like to balance academic philosophy with other ways of knowing, for example, shamanistic ways of knowing, mystical ways of knowing, spiritual ways of knowing. So working all of those into an approach to understanding consciousness is kind of my integrative approach. I want to include the four ways of knowing, the philosopher's gift, the scientist's gift, the shaman's gift, and the mystic's gift.
In your book, you really cover so many different ways that consciousness operates in the world and confusion that a lot of people have about consciousness. Because science, for instance, doesn't get it, right?
Well, yes, and it cannot get it. As you know, the scientific method is based on what's called sensory empiricism. In other words, exploring the world and gathering data using our senses and technological extensions of those senses. But you're never going to detect consciousness with your eyes or your nose or your ears or any of the senses. Certainly no technology can detect consciousness. So science, actually, as it's currently practiced, cannot investigate consciousness. The most it can do is investigate the brain, the nervous system, in neuroscience and cognitive science, or study behavior as it does in many forms of psychology. But an actually direct science of consciousness is something that is unavailable to science as long as it self-restricts its methodology to relying on the senses. Basically, they're basically then saying all that we can study and all that we want to study is the physical world, but consciousness is not part of the physical world. It's not physical.
And yet when scientists talk to you and say, well, consciousness can't exist, well, you have a very immediate response to them.
Yes, there are some philosophers and scientists out there. Richard Dawkins is one of those scientists who denies the reality of consciousness as anything other than just mechanisms going on in the brain and the nervous system. And so there are some extreme materialists, and they say that consciousness actually doesn't really exist. All that exists is the brain and electrochemical activity in the brain, and that we need to eliminate consciousness from our vocabulary. And words like mind and desire and love and all of those other words associated with consciousness, they basically say are meaningless and that consciousness doesn't exist. So when I'm talking to people who make that claim, I point out that they seem very, very motivated to make that point. And of course, you can't have motivation unless you have consciousness. So people who deny consciousness already are demonstrating that they are conscious and that consciousness exists. So they're engaging in what philosophers call a performative contradiction, that their actual performance, their behavior, contradicts what they claim.
Right. They're using consciousness to talk to you.
They're using consciousness to deny the fact of consciousness, and that's a contradiction.
Right. Yeah. So right away we understand that science doesn't understand in a basic format way. So what are we really looking at here in terms of who is going to understand consciousness? Who can talk about it scientifically so that we can appreciate it? Doesn't it have to do with more experience than with scientific formula?
Well, of course, consciousness is essentially experience. And one of the big paradoxes, of course, of science, a science that either extremely denies the existence of consciousness, but most scientists actually are not that extreme. They recognize, of course, that it exists, but they think it's something that's produced by the brain and the nervous system. But nobody can ever explain, even begin to explain, how the brain, which is made up of physical matter, could ever produce non-physical mind or consciousness. So science is in the awkward position of not being able to study consciousness or to tell us anything about consciousness, including subjective experience, yet every single piece of scientific data that has ever existed began as the subjective experience in some scientist's consciousness. So subjectivity, experience, consciousness is the foundation of science, and yet science can tell us nothing about it. So in a sense, and I make this point in my book, Blind Spots, that in some ways, science is itself, by its own criteria, is unscientific.
That's great. Now let's talk about consciousness and what it includes, because you talk about consciousness going all the way down to atoms and subatomic particles. So how are those conscious? That, in other words, you're saying that matter is conscious.
That's correct, yeah. I'm saying that the only way we can understand coherently the relationship between mind and body, between consciousness and our own bodies, is to begin with the assumption that the matter we are made of at every level, our cells, our molecules, our atoms, our subatomic particles, all of those must have some degree of sentience or consciousness, some degree of awareness going on, because we're made of that stuff and we are conscious. And the only way to explain, to account for the fact that we are embodied beings made of matter and yet we have consciousness and experience is if whatever we are made of also has some possibility, some degree of consciousness and experience, and therefore the only way to account for the fact that we are embodied conscious beings is that consciousness must go all the way down into every cell, every molecule, every atom, every subatomic particle. Matter, in other words, is intrinsically sentient. Matter actually has the ability to feel, to be aware, to make choices.
I think the point is that matter contains form, or is made up of form, and form needs to be made from choice. Form is held by the molecules and by the atoms. So they must have some sense of purpose and intelligence to maintain their structure.
Well, I think factually that is true. Logically, I don't think it's necessary that something needs consciousness to maintain structure. I mean, it's at least conceivable in a purely zombie universe, in other words, a universe made up just of pure physical stuff, that it would still have forms, it would still have structure. The main reason that we need to acknowledge the fact that consciousness exists in matter is that everything that exists, whether it's an electron or a proton or a human being, is always, everything that actually exists is always surrounded by a halo or a cloud of possibilities. At every moment, everything that's actual has a range of options that it can choose among. And so it needs to make a choice among the available options, among the available possibilities, to manifest what's going to be actualized in the very next moment. And that requires awareness of the possibilities and then the ability to make choice, to choose one of those possibilities. And as quantum physicists would describe it, to collapse the wave function into the next actual aspect of reality.
Right.
We're surrounded by options and possibilities, and we need choice to be able to select among those possibilities and options.
Right. And I think that in many cases, the choices are very slim. There are only so many choices that a molecule can make.
Well, yeah, actually, I'm going to make a distinction here between choices and options. Our options can be limited, but nobody can take away our ability to make a choice as long as we are alive and conscious. So people can restrict our options, like you could be sealed up in solitary confinement, chained in a cave somewhere or by yourself. Your options are very, very limited in those circumstances, but you still always have choice. The ultimate choice that we always have, as long as we are alive and conscious, is the choice between accepting what is or resisting what is. So even the person chained up in a cave has the option to choose to accept his or her circumstance or to resist it. So we always have that choice. But nobody can take that away from us. But what can be taken away from us are the options that we have.
Right. And let's talk about free will, because that's a part of your book also. And really, that's what we're looking at here. There is free will to choose, and people, I think, get carried away with how much freedom is in the will if the options are very limited. People say free will is unlimited, and we can really use it to create anything. I believe that we're really constricted a lot in life by patterns, patterns of reality, patterns even of our own personality. There are ways that free will doesn't reveal itself enough for it to be broad enough. There aren't enough options.
As I say, we can always make a choice, but the fact that we can always make a choice doesn't mean that we can have everything we want. Because in the universe, as I describe it, everything that exists has some degree of sentience. So every animal, every plant, every cell, every atom, every molecule, and so on, every subatomic particle has the ability and is making choices at every moment. Therefore, there are innumerable gazillions of choices being made throughout the world, throughout the cosmos at every moment, among which is the choice that we make. But our individual choice is just a tiny moment within this cosmic symphony of choices that's being made at every moment. The phrase that I use is that we get to vote, but we don't get to decide the outcome. Every one of us, and by us I don't just mean humans, I mean all sentient beings throughout the cosmos, every one of us is participating in what I call the cosmic democracy. We are all making choices at every moment, but the reason we don't always get what we want is everything else that has consciousness is also making choices at every moment, and some of those choices combine and align, and some of them conflict and cancel each other out. And so in the end, what is going to manifest is the result of the cosmic democracy, of all the balance of the choices that are being made by all sentient beings at every single moment. Right. And that's why we don't always get to choose the outcome.
That's great. Wonderful explanation. Now I want to ask you about this great creation of the universe called the Big Bang that seems to be created from nothing. That's a blind spot, right?
Well, in many ways, that's the biggest blind spot of them all, because it involves what I would call ridiculous assumption that something began from nothing. Point out in the first chapter in Blind Spots is that you cannot get something from nothing. If you begin with nothing, that's all that ever exists. Nevertheless, the standard cosmology in modern science says that the universe, at least in some versions of it, is that the universe began in a Big Bang, and before the Big Bang, there was the void, there was nothing. Well, if that was really true, there never could have been a Big Bang. Something had to exist for the Big Bang to happen. And so the idea that the Big Bang came into being from nothing is totally meaningless. There must have been something before the Big Bang. I'm not denying that the Big Bang happened. It may well have happened. But it was not the beginning of everything. Something must have existed before the Big Bang. And more than likely, that something was the entire cosmos itself. Our universe probably had a beginning 14 point something billion years ago, perhaps 13.7 billion years ago. So the universe had a beginning. It has a lifespan and will come to an end. But the universe takes place in a sequence of infinite universes, which is what we call the cosmos. So the cosmos always existed, and universes come into and out of being within the eternal cosmos.
It's very hard to grasp always. Infinity is very hard to adjust to. And it's fascinating because one of the things you talk about in the book is that our universe has expanded and then it's contracting and will eventually return to a very small size, almost the size that it started with, or maybe exactly. And then all of a sudden there's another Big Bang and a new universe is created. And maybe there are many universes created one after another through infinity. Mm-hmm. And maybe before us, there have been trillions of universes just as large and as time-consuming as ours has been. So it's quite a large concept to comprehend.
It might even be the biggest. I would agree. I would say that there has been an infinity of universes, that there never was a first universe and there never will be a last universe, that universes always come into being and out of being, and that that's been going on, the phrase would be, since the beginning of time, except there was never a beginning to time. It always existed. That process has always been happening.
Let's cut to a new topic, and that's why our society, our planet, is degrading so much. And you talk about that in the book, that we have an assumption about our own consciousness being superior.
Yeah. In fact, it's not just that many humans think that human consciousness is superior. I think that probably the vast majority of humans who spend any time thinking about these issues would make that assumption. But even worse than that is the assumption that only humans have consciousness and only creatures with brains or nervous systems have consciousness. And if that's the case, then clearly the rest of the planet around us, the rest of this beautiful globe, doesn't have any of its own intrinsic consciousness. And therefore, without consciousness, it doesn't have intrinsic meaning or purpose or value. And so we then deny, don't recognize, don't acknowledge the fact that the world that we inhabit, that in fact the world out of which we arose with our embodiment and our consciousness, is itself also embodied and conscious. The only way that we could exist in this world is if what we came from possesses exactly what we have, the ability to be conscious and the ability to be embodied. So because we take this idea that humans are special, because we have these special brains with special consciousness, that the rest of the planet doesn't have that, that has given the industrial and post-industrial civilizations the idea that we can do whatever we like to rape the environment for resources to serve the need and the greed of human populations. Well, we know what the devastating consequences of that have been. So what we need to do, one of the biggest blind spots we really need to address, if we're going to have any chance of surviving the current ecological crisis, is to give up the myth of human specialness and to recognize that we are not special because we have consciousness. In fact, that every other species has some degree of consciousness, and that we are just one species among all the other species. And we need to adopt the attitude that indigenous peoples have from time immemorial and still do today, which is to recognize that humans are just one species, one nation, one people among all the nations, all the other animals and plants and species of the world. We need to recognize that we are part of an integrated ecosystem.
It's not about how smart we are, because as a human civilization, we're always patting ourselves on our backs as to how smart we are. But something is missing in your book. You talk about that, and that's the wisdom.
Yeah, we need to make a big difference, a distinction between intellectual intelligence and wisdom. We're smart in the sense that we can calculate things, and we've developed machines that actually help us calculate much faster and much deeper than the human brain seems to be able to do on its own. So with this technology, we've become very smart. We have smart devices, smartphones, smart this, smart fridges, smart vacuum cleaners, and so on and so on. Yeah, we're a very smart species, but if we don't also have compassion and a sense of our belonging to a much larger system, an awareness of our interdependence, then the smartness is not all that smart because it lacks wisdom. So we need wisdom, we need compassion, awareness of our connectedness, our relatedness to the rest of the world around us, for our smarts to actually expand to include wisdom and to be actually able to serve us in the end. At the moment, our smarts are endangering us rather than adding to our ability to thrive.
Sure. I always say that this is a very stupid species. That we really aren't as smart as we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't be very difficult to find lots of really smart and lots of wise human beings. So I think we are as smart, we're an intelligent species, we are Homo sapiens, but we are also Homo stupiditas as well. So we're all the
right. I agree that there's more to it. Certainly, if we look around us and we see what's going on, we can understand that a lot of people who seek power aren't necessarily the most intelligent people around.
Well, yes, we need to make a distinction between humans in general and then specific groups of human beings. So right now, the human beings that dominate the planet are the ones that some time ago began telling the story to themselves that humans are special, and they broke away from the indigenous ancestors who recognized that we're no more special than any other species. And so from that cosmological story, that myth that humans are special, we then began to develop agriculture and then industry and right now the information revolution. We're moving further and further away from our sense of connectedness to the world around us. In that sense, modern industrial civilization is anything but smart or intelligent. It certainly isn't wise. So it's not that the human species itself is necessarily stupid, but that most of us have chosen a path and develop systems that we now get caught up in them that just sweep us along, that is not a very wise, because it's not a very sustainable way of life. It doesn't take into account the well-being of all the other interdependent species around us that we depend on for our health and well-being and for our ability to thrive and survive. If we don't take care of our environment, we won't be taking care of ourselves either.
What's very important is that for a lot of us who want things to improve, we work on, let's call it, distance healing.
Yes.
You have a chapter on healing in your book, because it's how to use our consciousness using information, because healing is about working with information and sharing information in ways that might alter people's minds or even people's bodies, the information in their energy fields that reflect on their bodies. Can you address that?
Well, yes. You were earlier talking about distant healing as one aspect of healing. And I do have a detailed chapter in my book on the topic of healing that is often called energy healing. And I point out in the book that probably, particularly in cases of remote healing, distant healing, healing that happens instantaneously at a distance, then it cannot be energy. There cannot be any energy transmission taking place, because it takes energy time to move from point A to point B. And so if there is distant healing instantly, then it means that no energy can have passed between the healer and the healee. So something else must be taking place. And so what I think is happening is that what the healing is taking place through intention, through consciousness, not through energy. So the healer creates an intention, behold, be healed. And then the recipient, it doesn't matter where that person is, it could be the other side of the globe on another planet, it makes no difference, because distance doesn't have any relevance to consciousness. Consciousness does not exist in space. It is non-located, it is non-spatial. Consciousness exists in time, but not in space. And so distance is irrelevant to consciousness. So the healer can be anywhere and the healee can be anywhere in the world. The healer creates the intention and the meaning of be whole or be healed. And that meaning is instantly shared by the recipient, by the patient or the healee. And then when that meaning is received, and not received, but when that meaning is shared within the body, within the consciousness of the cells of the patient, then those cells begin to use this new meaning, this intention to be healed, to redirect the energy in the patient's body in a way that then brings about physiological healing within the system, within the organic system of the healer, of the healee, of the patient.
Right.
So what's happening is a sharing of meaning, a sharing of intention, not a transmission of energy.
So what we're doing is we're sharing information, we're sending information, and if I'm sending healing to somebody, what I'm really doing is informing their energy. I'm not sending energy, but I'm informing their own energy how it might do a better job.
That's very well said, yes. And we're not even sending the intention. The intention doesn't waft through space. It's the intention is created in consciousness, and it doesn't exist anywhere in space. You know, right now, you and I have the intention to have this conversation, and all the scientists in the world could come into our respective rooms or studios looking for our intention, even if they opened up our brains and went through every single neuron in our brains, they would still never discover the intention that we share. So we both share the meaning, the intention to communicate, but that intention itself does not exist in physical space. And because it doesn't exist in space, it doesn't take time for us to participate in sharing the meaning of that intention.
Yeah, what I'm trying to understand is that the intention is really just information. It's purpose. So I have a purpose of creating information that can help the person I'm trying to help. Mm-hmm. And they're receiving that information that follows my purpose.
Well, I'd put it differently. I wouldn't say they're receiving the information, because receiving implies a transmission across space, and information requires both energy and consciousness. So information, I also have a chapter in information in blind spots. Information is changes in energy. So there's a state
Right.
of energy, and then something changes in that energy. And that change in energy is perceived by some being with awareness, by some sentient being. So information requires both components. It requires a change in the physical world, a change in the energy patterns, and then some conscious, some sentient being that is able to read or be aware of those changes in the energy. So, for example, if you have a DVD or a CD disc, people will just, without thinking, they will say, oh, well, the disc is full of information. It's not full of information. The disc is full of data. The data only become information when some being, some aware being, is able to read or perceive the changes, the patterns encoded on the disc, through putting it in a laptop or a DVD player, whatever it might be. Now there is some awareness that's able to read the changes in the energy patterns on disk. So information requires both. It requires changes in energy and then some sentient being to be aware of those changes in energy. So when healing takes place, it's not that there is a transmission of information from the healer to the healee. There is an intention created in the consciousness of the healer that is then instantly shared. The meaning of that intention is shared by the recipient, by the healee, and then, as you said a moment ago, then the energy in the cells of the recipient's body then redirect their own energy to be more harmonious and balanced and healing and helpful within the patient's body.
Right, so it's mutual. But what if I want to heal somebody's pet at a distance and they have no idea that I'm even around? How can I affect healing for somebody's dog, for instance?
Well, it doesn't require that we call them the recipient, even though nothing has actually been transmitted. But just for the sake of simplicity, we will call the healee the recipient. The recipient doesn't need to be aware of what's going on in the mind and the consciousness of the healer. And so whether the recipient is a dog or a human being or a bacterium or a cat or a worm makes no difference. It's the consciousness within the cells of the
oh,
recipient.
Right.
That is sharing in the meaning and the intention,
right.
Be healed.
That's
and
perfect.
So the cells of a dog will respond exactly the same way as the cells of a human would. The human or the dog right. don't need to be aware, consciously aware, at the level of their own organism.
That's great. We're running out of time, though, so I want to thank you for so much information in such a short time. Hopefully we can talk again at some point and explore consciousness farther. And there's so many incredibly brilliant parts to your book, Blind Spots, 20 Good Reasons to Think Before You Talk. And your name is Christian De Quincey. How can people find you?
Well, they can find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook page called Consciousness for Life, or they can find me on my website, which is christiandequincey.com, and De Quincey is spelled DEQUINCEY.com, christiandequincey.com, and they can have access to a lot of my other information, samples of my work and my blogs through my website.
Right. Christian, thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thanks, Peter. Likewise.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at prn.fm. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.